Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It is the largest migration in United States history, the California Gold Rush. In the mid-1800s, the pursuit of the discovery of gold drew hundreds of thousands to California. And many African Americans also began making the trek across the country with the same dream. And many black miners were confined to an area off Folsom Lake, now named Negro Bar. The use of the name was seen in newspapers as early as 1950. While the area is a part of history, over the course of recent years, many have tried to get the name changed. Joining us now to talk about the latest effort to rename the area of Folsom Lake's State Recreation Area is Cap Radio's race and equity reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
So for those who aren't familiar, describe this spot, Negro Bar.
Sure. To give a bit of understanding of the place, this is a particular entry point to the Folsom Lake area. It's a pretty popular place to kayak and paddleboard. There's a great overlook of the American River where you can look out and see the particular spot where black miners first discovered gold. Overall, it's incredibly picturesque. And so in some ways, it's actually extremely unfortunate that it is given this particular name.
What did you learn about the history of this place's name?
So according to the State Parks Department, this particular name was first seen being used during the gold rush, actually, in the 1850s, when black miners discovered gold in this part of the American River. The historic town site of Negro Bar was south of the historic city of Folsom, just across the American River. And so you can actually see where it used to be if you just basically go to the outlook point there and look across the river, which is really nice. At its peak, the town had around 500 to 600 residents who were mostly African American. But I think what is most important to remember or to keep in mind around today's modern day discussion around the place's name is that the town of Folsom that surrounds this area is now actually majority white. Mm-hmm. You are correct that back in the day, this was one of the few places that black people could mine for gold.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so with that context, I mean, this name is pronounced a few different ways. Is there an official way to pronounce it?
So unfortunately not, which pains me, especially knowing the demographics of the town now. And just how things have shifted, it's, you know, particularly, you know, I feel uncomfortable saying it as a reporter who reported this story. State Parks has told me that any pronunciation of the name of the park is purely based on dialect. So they say there is no official pronunciation. I have heard folks say to me that this name is of Spanish origin, but State Parks says contrary to that popular belief, this is not a Spanish origin name, mm-hmm. given that bar is not a Spanish word. However, I personally have just been pronouncing it more in the Spanish pronunciation with a short E, just because, frankly, I think it's very difficult to say it the other way, given its modern context. I think others may take this approach as well, from what I've heard.
Yeah, and calls for a name change has really been happening for years now. And as with most debates, it's far from a straight line. So what is the debate over this potential name change?
Yeah, I think the debate part is the most fascinating. This has been happening for years now, and people familiar with the area probably know that this name has been contentious for a very long time. But, you know, it is seen as, I think at the core, this name is seen as outdated at best. And of course, at worst, it is a deeply offensive racial slur. And folks that I guess its most staunch advocate for keeping the name as it is right now is Michael Harris. He's a local Black historian. He feels that the name is something that was given to honor the legacy of Black miners in the area. And he feels the discussion around the area's particular name is just drawing attention away from the true history of the place. Here he is.
Given the contextual nature of the time frame in question, 1840 to 1875, the notion of focusing on the name is intentionally disrespectful. It presupposes disparaging treatment, and it certainly negates any of the contributions of the people of African descent in the Gold Rush era.
And it's also important to add just a bit of background here. I also spoke with Betty Williams at the Sacramento NAACP, who told me that even in her lifetime, she's seen this term evolve. Here she is.
During that time, the word Negro was considered a professional and a word that described professional, hardworking African-American individuals, African-American Blacks. And I remember when my grandfather from Mississippi, I went to the store and when I was a little girl, and I'd never seen a Black person work there before. And so the word during those days was Black. And so I told my grandfather, I said, God, Granddad, there's a Black girl working there. And his response to me is like, girl, that girl ain't Black. She's a Negro. And he said it with such pride. I just still remember that conversation to this day. And so I thought, oh, okay, that's his era. That's a pride sense.
She says her real question is, should a park name reflect the historical accuracy of a time, or should it reflect the sentiment, but in modern terms?
Now we're here in 2022, and you have a different generation. So you go from Negro to Black to African-Americans, and then some folks have gone back to Black.
Yeah, that's an important question to ask. What other folks say?
On the other hand, of course, there's been a pretty strong coalition of people who've been pushing to change the park's name for years as well. The Sacramento NAACP says they basically said they were going to leave this decision on the name change up to residents, as the debate was actually dividing their members within their chapter as well. So on the flip side, people like Folsom resident Jen Johnson, who is a Black woman, they say that the park's name is uncomfortable and it makes it seem as if the term is okay to use. Johnson says it's particularly difficult because the town of Folsom is today less than 4% Black currently and 70% white. She just says, given those demographics, it's very difficult to have a park named this.
I'm not showing up to go to a place called Negro Bar where every other person is in white skin using that term. I mean, the fact to me that I've never had one of my white friends asked me, hey, Jen, do you want to go to Negro Bar? Because that's uncomfortable for them. Sit in this discomfort. Why is that uncomfortable to you? You know, like, it's not an okay term to use. So why are we using it as a state park name?
Johnson adds that she hopes state parks will find a way to both preserve the legacy of honoring the contribution of Black miners, but also without disrespecting Black people in the future.
If we're trying to move forward and educate ourselves and be better, we want to love on our future generations. And if people like me that are, you know, young, you know, late 20-somethings are saying and screaming from the hilltop, this word has been used in this community to hurt me, please stop using it. Again, the least we could do is bend to that and help them feel more welcomed. And hopefully I can go to that park someday without feeling absolutely sick to my stomach about that name.
Okay, Sarah, so what is State Parks doing about all of this?
State Parks says they'll be considering some alternative names and taking an official vote on the name change at the start of the summer. It's not written in stone. State Parks could, the commission could vote to say, no, we don't feel that a name change is necessary, but they are at least going to bring it to a discussion and a vote. They've got some alternatives that have been picked out. These include Black Miners Bar, Black Freedom Bar, and Historic Negro Bar.
And it's important to mention, this is part of a larger initiative with state parks. It isn't even the first time in recent months that state parks look to acknowledge a more diverse gold rush history. And you did some recent reporting on another part of this.
Yes, yes. So this discussion around the renaming of this area is all centered around this larger effort by state parks to make its properties more inclusive of the diverse history of Californians. Earlier this month, as you mentioned, state parks actually officially dedicated a trail in Coloma, near where gold was first discovered, to honor the contribution of Chinese miners in the area. There's also an ongoing discussion about a Black family who has claimed to own part of the land that now makes up Marshall Gold Discovery State Park. That's an ongoing discussion about if that land should be returned or how that family should be honored. And state parks mentioned that they have been doing a pretty, I don't know if aggressive is the right word, but certainly they've been reconsidering a lot of the names of their parks as of recent. They mentioned a place called Patrick's Point, which has been renamed to honor the indigenous tribes who used to inhabit the area since it was brought up that Patrick was actually a person who was horrible to the indigenous people who lived there. And so they've, kind of shifted who they should be honoring and who should be the focus of that park, which I think is great. I think overall what we're learning is that the history of the gold rush is incredibly diverse. And I hope that just in the coming years, we'll see a lot more acknowledgement of this.
You definitely have a lot of work ahead of you, a lot to follow, Sarah.
Totally. Yes.
Thank you so much. Sarah Mizes-Tan is CAP Radio's race and equity reporter. Up next, it's been called the year of the parent. We'll explore how parents across party lines are fueling elections around the state. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. There are Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Libertarians, Green Party voters, and the list goes on. Well, there may be another political party to add to that list. It may need a better or catchier name, but it is the angry parent voter. And some have called 2022 the year of the parent, as highlighted by some key victories in recall elections around the state, and notably in one of the most liberal of cities, San Francisco. We're going to dive deeper into a school board recall vote in San Francisco that has our first guest, a longtime California political columnist, calling what happened a, quote, three-alarm warning for Democrats. We'll also be joined by a local grassroots organizer who started the group Reopen California Schools. He admittedly was not politically active, for years voted no party preference, but was motivated enough to run for public office and fight for his children's schools to reopen, after he says politicians kept breaking promise after promise. But let's start with the premise of the year of the parent. Where is it happening? Why? And how is it starting to impact the political landscape in California? Joining us is political columnist with the Los Angeles Times, Mark Barbarak. Mark, welcome.
Hi, Vicki.
You're a veteran journalist covering politics in California for a long time. Can you explain this concept of the year of the parent and what it means politically, especially as we head towards the midterms?
Sure. Let me start by there's been some misapprehension about what happened in San Francisco. So briefly, let me say what it was not. I mean, it was not what I would call a political earthquake. You know, earthquakes come suddenly and unexpectedly. This was pretty much preordained from the minute the liberal establishment got behind this recall effort. And that's an important point I'm going to come back to. The other thing is, you know, earthquakes are they reorder a whole landscape. And that didn't happen in San Francisco. You know, San Francisco hasn't become a conservative bastion overnight. They're not going to elect Larry Elder or Donald Trump Jr. as the next mayor. What happened was a backlash, and that's going to get to what we're talking about, the angry parent. It was a backlash against a school board that was seen as, you know, to use the old expression, fiddling while Rome burned. You know, schools were closed longer in San Francisco than they were in other communities. Parents were in an uproar, and the board was focused on things like renaming schools, taking Abraham Lincoln and George Washington and Dianne Feinstein's names off schools. They were debating things for hours, whether a gay white male was representative and should have been on a diversity panel. They took away the merit-based entry system to Lowell High School, which is a very cherished institution in San Francisco. So the point, you know, maybe four or five of you listeners will understand this reference. There was a guy long ago, Michael Dukakis, who ran for president, and he said, it's not about ideology, it's about competence. So this was not about ideology, this was about competence, and more to the point, a sense that the school board was just the three school board members were just not competent, were just not addressing the issues that parents cared about.
That they were essentially out of touch with the priorities of parents in that school board or in that school district.
That's right. You know, in a column, I quoted Lizelle Hickey. She's a longtime Republican strategist. She works in particular on suburban women voters. But she's the one who coined this term, year of the angry K-12 parent. You know, people in the politics business are always looking. You can remember there are soccer moms and NASCAR dads and office park dads. The year of the angry K-12 parent, she's calling this. And quoting her now, she said, they are mad and they want to hold someone accountable. You know, what's happened is we've had 2+ years of lockdowns, of masks. I mean, life has been weird and crazy and unsettling and anxious. And people are tired and they're frustrated and they want to vent and they want to take it out on someone. And those someones happen to be Democrats in a lot of places, which is why I call this a three-alarm warning for Democrats. People are ticked off and they want to take it out on someone. And Democrats right now are in the line of fire.
Right. And calling not an aftershock, but a foreshock to that major earthquake that you were talking about. You know, we know that voters usually turn their frustration on the incumbent party. California, obviously, overwhelmingly Democrat. Is this an opportunity for Republicans to make some headway in the state at all levels of government?
You know, I'm really, really dubious of that. You know, after the recall, I said that, you know, Gavin Newsom is pretty much a shoo-in to be reelected, you know, unless he were to go back to the French Laundry and sign a bill opening up the entire state to offshore oil drilling, then he might have a problem. I mean, look, Republicans structurally, philosophically, there's a lot of reasons why Republicans are in so much trouble in California. I don't see them making any huge breakthroughs in California. There's some, you know, some congressional races that are very, very competitive. Republicans might enjoy an advantage there. I don't see them winning statewide office in California. Around the country, obviously, control of the Senate, control of the House. That's a different story.
Yeah. You touched upon this, but, you know, there's the argument that politicians, they pander to their constituents. They never get anything done. Any reason why now going into our third year into a pandemic, this may hit home harder with parents?
Well, again, I think there's just this level of frustration that is out there that transcends partisanship, that transcends parties. I mean, it works on two levels. You know, as you mentioned, midterm elections tend to be a referendum on the party in power in the White House. And you have two things that happen. Happy people, contented people typically don't vote, right? Things are fine. They got stuff to do. They're shopping. They're watching a movie. They're doing whatever. It's like, why bother? People who are angry, people who are really ticked off, they make it a point to vote. And so you've got that. You know, Republicans are very, very energized. The other thing that could happen, apart from people being apathetic, are people are discouraged. They're bummed out. You're a Democrat. Things aren't going great for you. So you stay home. And so the electorate, you know, is overwhelmingly, in this case, overwhelmingly Republican. That's a concern for Democrats as well, that their voters are apathetic. Or, you know, you can see a lot of folks, like I said, you know, parents who are just, you know, not looking at partisanship, not looking at R's and D's. They're just angry. And fairly or not, you know, you can say Democrats follow the science, whatever. Fairly or not, Democrats have been seen as the party of restrictions, of masks, of lockdowns, of closures. And, you know, again, people are just tired of all that stuff. I've seen polling that suggests parents are more concerned about their kids falling behind educationally than they are about them getting COVID. And I think that's what's driving a lot of this backlash that we've seen.
Mm. You know, people vote on their lived experiences in schools. It is a unifying issue regardless of party lines. Midterm elections are now less than 8 months away, from COVID to crime to even homelessness. What are you hearing from some of the big issues that will actually inspire people to go out and vote?
You know, you said something I think is very, very perceptive and insightful. You said people vote on their lived experience. You know, it's like someone is hot or cold and you tell them, well, no, you're not hot or cold. I mean, how do you know, right? So you can talk about all sorts of statistics about crime. Well, crime is actually down and yada, yada, yada. But people don't perceive it that way. We've had a number of high profile crimes involving smash and grab robberies, particularly here in the Bay Area where I live. And so even though statistics say that crime is not off the charts, people feel that crime is out of control. People feel unsettled. People feel anxious about that. So it goes back to what you describe as their lived experience. So I think we're seeing crime rising as an issue. You know, homelessness very much. That's not a perceptual thing. I mean, anyone who steps out anywhere in a major city in California could tell you that homelessness seems to be a problem that has gotten much, much worse. I mean, I know in San Francisco, it's been a problem for decades, but it seems to be spreading in California and getting worse. So homelessness, crime, unsettlement, if you want to call it that, from the pandemic, all those things are issues that are bubbling and probably will be, I think, all the way until November. I mean, I don't think folks are going to forget the frustration they felt, even if schools are open, even if the stores are brimming with stock that is now absent. I think there's a long hangover to a lot of this stuff. And I just think this generalized anxiety is going to continue into November. And again, that doesn't bode well for Democrats.
Yeah, right. The wounds of frustration are fresh. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the governor's race is largely safe. But are there any other races that you think have the potential to gain significant interest in California?
I think the race for attorney general could be an interesting one. I know your district attorney there in Sacramento, Anne Marie Schubert, is running as an independent. There's a couple of Democrats who are running. Rob Bonta, the appointee, is seeking full election to the term. I think of all the races on the ballot, that could potentially be the most interesting because the issue of crime is so ascendant. And it could be a referendum and perhaps some backlash. You know, in California, the trend over the last several years in election cycles has been one toward remediation, toward easing up perhaps on what some have seen as an overly harsh criminal justice system, particularly as it deals with Black and brown people. I think we may be seeing some backlash to that effort and that movement, and that might, I say this might, play out the attorney general's race. If there's one statewide race that I'll keep an eye on that I think is worth watching, it's that one.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that one. Mark, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Mark Barabak is a political columnist with the Los Angeles Times. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're talking about the power of the parent voter, taking out their frustration at the ballot box, and what that means for the upcoming midterms. California may have ended its mask mandate for fully vaccinated people, but that doesn't apply to schools. And that's a move that prompted protests across the state in the days that followed, and led some school districts to move forward with masking optional without the state's blessing. That includes Roseville Joint Unified High School District in Placer County and El Dorado Union High School District. Last week, the state alluded it would likely lift the school mask mandate as early as next week, and for some parents, it is a long time coming. Joining us now is Jonathan Zacherson. Jonathan is the founder of Reopen California Schools, a grassroots effort which fought to keep schools open after the initial shutdowns in mid-2020 during the onset of the COVID pandemic. Jonathan, welcome to Insight.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're a parent from Roseville in Placer County, and you describe yourself as apolitical, kind of middle of the road, voting no party preference. You then founded Reopen California Schools and decided to run for California Assembly. Connect the dots for us. What led you to that point?
That's correct. I used to describe myself as a social media hermit, was pretty apolitical at the time. Didn't know who most of the people that represented me were. But then when schools closed, I saw how my kids were suffering, and I wanted to do something. And so I got involved, and luckily we had some good school board members where we were locally that found out that the issue was at the state level. And that's when I founded Reopen California Schools to try to make a difference at the state level to help everybody, but also my kids.
2 full years into the pandemic, a year and a half later after your organization was created, who are the parents that are part of Reopen California Schools?
It varies. I mean, we have people all over the state, Democrat, Republican, Independents. You know, as you alluded to, I was non-party preference. And it's after we've seen the pandemic hit, it's very clear to me which party is the party of the parent, the party of the family. And so that's why I decided to support Republicans recently and become a Republican because of it. We have a lot of parents. I see it. They're still Democrats. They're registered Democrats, but this election they plan on voting Republican because of what the local officers in their area have done to their kids.
Hmm. We're talking about this concept of the year of the parent for 2022. What does that mean to you?
What it means to me is we're going to have a lot more parent involvement. We've seen, generally there's certain types of voters that vote. And as your last caller alluded to, there are going to be a lot more people engaged, including in the primaries. And so you're going to see parents finding out who those candidates are, finding out who those people are running for school board. I think that's going to be probably the most contentious seat in many areas. They're not going to be looking at the governor's race. They're not going to be looking at maybe very many congressional races, but they will be looking at the local races and maybe even to the assembly level. There's a few seats in California where I think they will flip to Republican because specifically because of this issue.
Okay, so honing in on the offices and officials that directly are in their backyard, why now? What's different from years past?
Well, one of the things is a lot of people didn't realize how much power the school boards have. You know, we've seen through the pandemic, there are certain schools that opened much earlier than others. And while some of that was because of the state, while the problems were because of the state, the other part was because of the local school board members chose not to listen to the families asking to reopen. So in Roseville, where my kids go to school, they were one of the first in the state to reopen as soon as they were able to. But then you had other areas, like you mentioned in San Francisco, that were closed the entire school year last year when they were able to open multiple times, but they chose not to. And so that's why we saw the recall, and that's why we're probably going to see a lot of attention paid to these school board races, which is where I plan on getting involved statewide.
Well, on the topic of school or local races, you threw your hat into the race for state assembly, but last week you called off your race. Why?
Yeah, no, that's so part of the reason why is in my district, someone else who's running, Joe Patterson, and there wasn't much difference between us. And, you know, I looked at that race and I thought, you know, he's likely to win, and it made sense to spend resources fighting in other races. So that includes the district next door, Assembly District 7 for Josh Hoover. He has the support of parents, and then also spend a lot of time focusing on these school board races across the state, which I think will have a much larger impact ultimately because of the power that we recognize they have.
You know, Jonathan, I imagine going from someone who was apolitical and no party preference to now being the creator of an organization and having an interest in local politics and actually running for offices, I would imagine there's been a learning curve in figuring out how these decisions are made, who makes them, and how they trickle down to local areas like Roseville. What has been most surprising to you in this journey?
Yeah, that's right. I think a lot of people think you just show up to a school board, you speak what you know, your opinions, and the school board makes a decision. But really, there's a lot of planning that goes behind the scenes to make some of those decisions happen. That's what we've seen here in Roseville. We have a very good group of parents that are organized, have a good relationship with our school board. You know, other areas, not so much. And that's what we want to change, is to help empower parents to use those tools that've been successful in places like Roseville and San Diego to see change. You know, especially most recently on this mask issue that you've talked about.
What are some of the biggest successes that your organization has accomplished?
Well, I think one aspect has to do with the media side. One of the biggest issues parents had was we were frustrated with how some of these issues were being framed. And again, this isn't necessarily media's fault, to a degree, but it has to do with where money is and where organization is. You know, if you have money, you have the ability to get your story out there, right? You have people, paid to do this. So learning that media curve was important. And I think getting a lot of the stories that we've seen out there from the Oakley, the Oakley school boards, school board members that resigned because they were complaining that parents wanted their babysitters back. There's a wonderful story of this daughter that after being home from school for over a year, her mom broke the news to her that she was able to go back, and she broke down in tears. Those are the kind of stories that we were able to help get out there. On top of that, it's some of the political ones, right? Learning, getting Roseville Joint Union and some of these other school districts to move forward with these mask optional policies. It's actually now over 20 school districts in the state that have mask optional policies in 9 different counties. And it is because of this grassroots organization effort, very loosely organized groups across the state. And so we're more organized than we've ever been. And it's time to take that organization to that next level, which is why I think we're going to have a big impact on the 2022 elections.
When talking about that next level, I mean, are you seeing other parents across the state, like, running for office?
Yes, there is a lot of interest in parents running for office. And not only a lot of interest in themselves, but at least finding the candidates and supporting candidates now. And so that is some of the efforts that I'm going to be working on now that I'm no longer running for assembly, is developing and helping those parents find the resources and get elected in those local offices. Because we need good parents, solid parents that put families first on these school boards.
Now that schools are open and you're working to have masks be optional for parents and students in California schools, and you've mentioned that, you know, roughly 20 districts have gone that route, defying the state's mandates for schools. But the state did acknowledge that, you know, the likelihood that mask mandates for school children would be lifted as early as next week. Is that a win or a success in your eyes?
Well, we'll see what happens on the 28th. You know, all we have is that they're going to come out with a date on the 28th. We don't know what that date is going to be, and we don't know what conditions will be required for that. So it could be based off of, you know, Newsom could come out and say March 31st, masks to be lifted at schools if a certain, you know, childhood vaccination rate is met or certain hospitalization rate is met. The problem, and this is why a lot of parents are frustrated, is they saw the Super Bowl, they saw the NFC Championship game pictures, they see that masks are lifted pretty much everywhere else in society, yet their children are still forced, in some cases, even outdoors, until recently, all day long. And they're upset and they're frustrated and they don't see why. I think it would be a little bit different if everybody was still wearing masks and we saw the governor wearing the mask at the football game, and that would be a different story, but they're not, and their kids are what they see is suffering needlessly when everybody else has a different set of rules.
What do you see? That's fallout. And what do you see as the fallout for the state's continued delays in revisiting or revising the state's current mandate for schools?
Well, we've lost a lot of parents have lost trust in public health because of this. They see the political nature of this. They don't look at it as science. They look at it as political science. And so since it's gone on so long, I don't think they will forget easily. And this will have an impact, not just in 2022, but probably in the next couple of election cycles until there's some sort of maybe other seismic shift that happens. This is ingrained in parents. I mean, they're very reactionary to anything that comes out. And it's going to take a lot of time to deprogram that if Democrats want to recover from this.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Jonathan Zacherson is the organizer and founder of Reopen California Schools, and he is located in Roseville, Placer County, with three children. Still ahead, a vibrant kinetic punch. The Evidence Dance Company graces the Mondavi Center at UC Davis this weekend. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Inside on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The art of dance is more than a sequence of rhythmic steps. It's an art that can open our minds and move us in ways previously unimagined. Dance is also one of humanity's most dynamic forms of storytelling. Vibrant displays of history, traditions, and values that can kick down walls and build stronger cultural bridges. For 35 years, the Evidence Dance Company, led by the nationally acclaimed Ronald K. Brown, has been utilizing this powerful art form to cultivate better understanding of African American history and culture, while reminding us of our individual and collective responsibility in social justice. The company will be bringing its distinctive dances to the Mondavi Center at UC Davis this Saturday. Joining us now from Evidence is Arcel Kabuag, the company's associate artistic director, along with dancer and Stockton native Christopher Salongo. Arcel and Christopher, welcome to Insight. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
Good afternoon.
Well, Arcel, starting with you, given that you are the associate artistic director, tell our listeners what the Evidence Dance Company is and what makes it different from other dance companies.
Wow. So Ronald K. Brown Evidence Dance Company, we are a dance company that shares storytelling through traditional dance and contemporary dance. And we share the story of the human condition. Our themes are about love, and to Ron, you know, love and God is the same thing, liberation and a responsibility, and most of all, community.
The mission of Evidence is to promote understanding of human experience, as you just mentioned, and that includes the African diaspora. How do you try to accomplish this through dance?
Ron uses it through a lens of spirituality, something that's universal. Then he uses Caribbean dance forms, traditional forms, dance forms from like South Africa, the Ivory Coast, Guinea, and uses these actual these movements that are used for celebration, for if somebody is having a baby, or for the rain, or for the farming and the crops, using these actual movements to help convey the feeling in dance. And then he uses that through storytelling. So it's not like done in an arbitrary way of just putting African dance on the stage, but using the actual feeling of these dances, what they mean to people, and then how it's universal to all of us.
Yeah.
Not even the African diaspora, but just anybody going through grief, going through pain, going anybody like searching for liberation.
Yeah, something that we can all relate to. Christopher, exactly. Want to bring you in. Ronald K. Brown is an accomplished dancer and choreographer, renowned for combining modern dance with West African and Afro-Caribbean dance. What have you learned from him, and how has he made you a better dancer?
The best thing I learned from Ron was he had told me as an apprentice to get rid of the good student mentality, quote unquote. And what I took away from that was to really just let go of the superficial part of just learning steps. There's something more to it than just the steps. It's delving into the spiritual aspect of what the step means, what it feels like. And it just allows me to really investigate self-knowledge and self-experience in this process. And I think that's a challenge that never really stops. And it's something that I enjoy and will always go through.
Yeah, and something obviously people are receptive to. The New York Times described the dance company as one that packs a sophisticated and vibrant kinetic punch. Chris, what's the secret to sustaining a high degree of nuance and energy in every performance?
You know, just remembering why you wanted to dance, what you love about dance, and just leaving it all on stage, and just remembering that there's a purpose to the story that Ron put in this work. And if you're able to carry that story with you while you're on stage, it gives the audience something to take away from, something visceral that they can feel.
Yeah. Arcel, what brought you into Evidence Dance Company?
Wow. So I'm from the Bay Area. I auditioned for the Alvin Ailey School in Berkeley, California. I also used to dance at the Great America, Paramount Great America in San Jose. And when I was at the Ailey School, I moved to New York a little bit early so that I could watch classes. And I saw I was watching classes, and I saw this one class where I was like, I have never seen dance like that. Who is this? What kind of style is this? Like, what is the name of this? So fast forward, I was going to do my schedule with the director of the Alvin Ailey School, Denise Jefferson. And I told her, I was like, I want to be in that class that's in Studio 3 at 2:00. And she's like, that's actually Ailey 2. That's like the second company. You have to audition to be in that. But Ron Brown will be setting a piece on the students at the Ailey School at the end of the year. In order to be in this this performance, you had to audition, and you had to be in certain levels to even be in the audition. I wasn't in those levels yet, but I was in ballet class the day of this audition. I could hear the music coming from upstairs. I could hear everyone pounding on the floor from the ceiling. So I asked the teacher if I could go to the bathroom, took off my ballet shoes, and just ran up the stairs and snuck into the audition. And Ron saw me, and he asked the teacher, you know, can you please make an exception for Arcel to be in the piece? And so that was the first time I got to work with Ron. The minute I was in the first rehearsal, I just knew, like, oh, this is why I moved to New York. It wasn't to go to to be in the Alvin Ailey Company or to be on Broadway. I was like, this is why I moved here. Mm-hmm. I could feel it. I could, just the way that Ron spoke to the dancers and the way the movement was, just so natural and rhythmical. And I was like, you know, when I started learning dance, I started doing tap dancing and jazz. And so just the sense of rhythm in my feet, I just felt it in his movement. And I was like, oh, this is gonna be my life's work. And I joined the company the following year. And then 4 years later, I became the associate artistic director.
I mean, you're describing a company that feels like a community Chris, you've described the dance company like a family. How has this family helped you grow over the years?
You know, it's taught me a lot of life lessons, like, for example, to just let go and just live through each experience and really tap into my spiritual self. And that's brought me closer to myself internally and also to my friends and family. And it just made me more open and just a better person.
A core foundation of Evidence Dance Company that we're learning is that art and social justice, they actually share a common foundation to move our society forward. Your dance company tries to really provide this unique view into really some heavy subjects, human struggle, tragedy, and triumph. How do you balance your own emotions when telling these emotional and even personal stories? Arcel, I'll start with you.
Wow, yes. I think Ron challenges us to be our authentic selves, to be genuine people. The dancers he picks for his company, he doesn't want to pick dancers that are wearing fake hair or like, you know, like lashes and just trying to be a facade of something else. He wants people that are just being genuine so that they can be representation of the human condition of people. When the audience comes to the show, they can see themselves on the stage, which is why he called the company Evidence, so we can be evidence of our legacies and our families and teachers. And I think when we're on stage, just being so open, when Chris mentioned spirituality, we have to be so open on the stage that we're not just putting on a show, that we're like, we're thinking about the stories that he tells us that can relate to our personal stories about, you know, somebody that maybe we lost this year and using that, you know, to dance through it, using the frustration that we might have during, you know, this difficult year that we've had, you know, and using that
difficult,
you know,
couple years.
Exactly. To fuel us and just like, oh, let's dance it out.
Yeah.
And I think when we are open that way and genuine on stage, then all of that can come out. And I think that's a great way for us to balance it so that when we go outside, you know, as we're global citizens, you know, we're kind of different people. And it's interesting you said that too, because I was thinking like when the pandemic started, there was this thing about, oh, who was essential and whose work is essential? And you know, as a dance company, I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess we're not going to do shows. But then when we started teaching dance on Zoom, and you know, when we did an evidence challenge, where a TikTok challenge, then we realized, oh, dance is important. It is essential right now. This is what, you know, people are turning in videos of themselves dancing in their bedroom. Or when Ron was teaching a community class online on Zoom, we had almost 100 people, and people from all over the world, Japan, Hungary, Brazil, all over the different states. And I was like, oh, this is incredible, because these people wouldn't be able to take his class in Brooklyn. And for us to offer this class every month and to see all these people from all over the world, no matter what time it was, and people are like, oh, it's 4:00 a.m. where I am right now. And we're like, oh, wow. And we're all dancing together. And I just think that sense of community, of bringing us together, it's like dance is essential. And it did make us feel very important.
I was one of those people dancing in the living room when everything was shut down. So no. I feel you on that. Christopher, I would imagine, you know, after everything that Arcel is talking about the last 2 years, that dance has taken on a deeper meaning for you, and especially in this realm of being authentic.
Yes, absolutely. And I think everything starts in rehearsal. And when you allow yourself to just let go and kind of put your own personal experiences in rehearsal and let that translate on stage, during rehearsals, sometimes we may cry. And, you know, that's just our truth in rehearsals. And sometimes that'll happen on stage too. And I think that's a beautiful thing to happen, because the audience just sees us as people, not just, you know, dancers, professional dancers doing steps, but no, we're people first. And I think that really owns in on the mission statement of Evidence, is just the human experience. And we're just people meeting people, sharing, nothing to prove, all things to share on stage.
Well, with that, in that authenticity, Chris, you're a Stockton native. You graduated from Sacramento State, and this is the first Evidence Dance Company performance in the Sacramento area at Mondavi Center at UC Davis. How does it feel to perform, and what will essentially be a homecoming performance for you?
I have no words to express how grateful and excited I am to be at the Mondavi. You know, I've watched a couple of shows at the Mondavi and just was just in awe of how beautiful the theater is, who was at the theater, and I just can't believe this full circle moment is actually happening. Like I've said to myself the first time I watched Twilitharp at the Mondavi that I want to perform on that stage, and I'm gonna do it now, and I get to see my teachers, friends, family, and even my sixth grade teacher that I reached out to, who is probably my earliest memory of when I fell in love with dance. And I'm just so happy that everyone's coming back and I get to see all of them.
Oh, it's gonna be an amazing night on Saturday. Or so when it comes to Saturday's performance at the Mondavi Center, what can someone expect to feel and to see if they've never seen the work done before by the Evidence Dance Company?
I think that they're gonna feel joy. They'll feel joy. I think they'll feel pain. They'll remember feelings that they have. There's also grief in the stories that we're sharing on Saturday. But ultimately, I think we want people to leave the theater feeling love. Yeah. And, you know, love, compassion, community. I think when anybody comes to the theater, that's what they see is different about us.
Yeah. You're going to be performing a new dance, right, at Mondavi Center called The Equality of Night and Day. Talk to us about the story that you're going to be telling through dance.
Yeah, so something interesting that I love about concert dance, modern contemporary dance, is that it's not always so literal, not like the Nutcracker or the Prince, you know, meets the princess and they live happily ever after, that like people can come to the theater and come up with their own stories and own feelings. But what I think about Equality Night and Day, I think about this time period of things being equal. Ron talks about the equinox. This was how the idea started, about the balance of the same amount of time and right between the night and day. And I think about just the balance that we have to have in ourselves, especially during this time. Feeling angry, feeling frustrated, feeling confused, but then the balance of like still having compassion and love. You know, you think about people like that, you know, going to go protest, like, you know, angry, you know, upset, like demanding that, you know, freedom and equality, but then having the balance of like staying calm. You know, staying calm, being respectful, doing it, you know, the proper way. So I think Equality of Night and Day in those aspects. You know, it just is, Ron brought up to me yesterday that like, oh, the Equality of Night and Day, that like this assumption that like we all think that everything is equal and everything's okay. And his example was like when we're in this pandemic and everyone thinks that, oh, everyone's being more careful now and everyone's being healthy and trying to be safe, but yet people are still dying, people are still being killed, people are being disrespected, people still don't want to wear a mask, you know. So it's like just like the equality of like finding balance just to live in this world and live in society, and then how do we navigate through that?
Well, thank you. I mean, really, you're just navigating through all of this with such thoughtfulness and creativity. Arcel and Christopher, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, absolutely. Thank yes. you. We look forward to seeing everyone on Saturday.
Oh, I'm sure they are looking forward to seeing you too. Arcel Kabuwag is the Dance and Associate Artistic Director of the Evidence Dance Company, along with dancer Christopher Salongo. Their performance will be at the UC Davis Mondavi Center this Saturday. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.